to the Scaling Japan Podcast, a podcast about how to grow your business from $100,000 and beyond.
And beyond.
In the land of the rising sun.
Welcome to the Scaling Japan Podcast.
I'm your host, Tyson Battino. And on today's episode, we have a very special guest, the man himself, the legend, Tim Romero.
Thanks for having me on, Tyson. I can't believe it's taken us this long to set it up.
It's been a while, but I think we have a lot to talk about. So Tim, if you haven't already heard, is the host of Disrupting Japan podcast. He is also a pioneer for foreign startups in Japan, and his content has not only inspired myself, but inspired countless foreign and Japanese entrepreneurs to make the startup journey. He is also the head of Google Startups Japan. And Tim, could you give a short introduction if I've missed anything?
Oh, I think that's going to be hard to live up to that introduction, but sure. I've started 4 startups in Japan over the last 25 years. I've sold 2, I've bankrupted 2, but 50-50 is not too bad for startups.
Pretty good, actually.
Yeah. My first one was in the dot-com era. Since then, I've worked in corporate venture capital. I helped spin up TEPCO's innovation division. I've done market entry for foreign startups coming into Japan. I'm currently head of Google for Startups Japan. And I started the Disrupting Japan podcast almost 9 years ago. I had no idea how popular it would become or how much interest Japanese startups would start receiving overseas.
It was really useful for me in my journey as well, because I started One Coin English about 9 years ago, actually.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm glad it helped.
And at the time, there was pretty much no content on starting a business as a foreigner in Japan, let alone English content.
There's a lot more foreigners in Japan now. There's a lot more foreigners starting businesses in Japan now. I mean, not to get off on too much of a tangent right away, but I do think that foreigners in Japan have a really outsized role to play in the startup ecosystem here.
Please tell me more.
Well, I think it's not just Japan. Even if you look at Silicon Valley, foreigners have had a large amount of influence. A lot of the most famous VCs, the famous foreigners, were not born in America. And the same thing in Japan. There's plenty of Japanese founders, but percentage-wise, there's a lot of foreigners starting companies here. And there's a lot of effort by the Japanese government, actually, both the national government and local governments, Tokyo, Shibuya, Fukuoka in particular, to support foreign founders specifically. But why that is, my own theory is there's 2 things that lead to it. I think one is the fact that just by nature, people who are willing to uproot their lives and move halfway around the world are, let's say, less risk averse than average, right? They're more likely to take a chance and take a plunge and do something crazy, like start a startup. And the second thing I think that, and this was definitely the case with me on my first startup, it's kind of out of necessity. If you move to a new country, you generally don't have those social support networks. You probably don't have a strong university network. A lot of the standard career paths aren't as open to you as they would be in your home country. So I think that just kind of naturally pushes foreigners in any country towards entrepreneurship or small business ownership.
I would agree with that 100%. Let's say creating a company out of necessity, that was exactly my case. I think I was around after I left my corporate HR position, 31. It was I know Japanese HR, but I have no idea about American HR. So I'm going to have to start from scratch. I've been pretty much just teaching. And it's okay, the only shortcut left for me is to make this business succeed.
Yeah. Nothing motivates like necessity.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. I mean, you've come all the way here, you've invested this much in Japan, so gotta make it work. Yeah, the reason I want to interview is just we've done a lot of interviews on doing sales, market entry, corporate venture capital, angel investment, pretty much all the stages, but we've never really took a 30,000 foot view of what is actually the state of startups in Japan in 2023. Oh, okay. some things that I've asked some second time founders, probably five of them. I got Tim Romero on the podcast. What do you hear from him? And pretty much hands down, everyone kind of really wants to hear your thoughts on, you know, the state of startups, but also kind of like what you think's coming up for Japan and things Japan can improve on. And also how, you know, the foreign founders in Japan, how can we also better support the ecosystem?
That's a big subject to get my hands around. And I should preface this to say that, like, as anyone who listens to Disrupting Japan knows, I am incredibly optimistic in general, by nature, perhaps. And sometimes I feel like I'm the biggest cheerleader for Japanese startups. So my take tends to be more optimistic than most, but I think it is a well-informed take. In terms of framing, when you're trying to tackle a question as big as, like, what's the state of startups in Japan, the baseline you set is really important. So if you're comparing Japan to San Francisco, it's going to come up short, but so will anywhere else on the planet. Definitely. So I think it's more reasonable to either compare Tokyo to secondary cities like Boston or London or Berlin or Singapore or to the way things were 10 or 15 years ago. And if we use those metrics, starting with like what's changed over the last 10, 15 years, well, that one in particular, I think the progress in the ecosystem has been absolutely astounding and transformative. The amount of venture capital available has increased more than tenfold in the last 10 years. The number of startups being founded has increased more than tenfold in the last 10 years. Looking forward, we have both the Kishida administration and Keidanren who've come in say that they're committed to another tenfold increase over the next 5 years, which is ambitious but doable. I think more importantly, though, in terms of innovation in general, so the numbers are important, the yen value and such, but the fact that there are so many startups now is good for Japanese innovation because a lot of startups now, their primary customers are other startups. And the reason this is important is because other startups will adopt technology much, much faster than SMBs or enterprise will.
Definitely.
And so if a startup becomes successful selling to other startups, they can use it as a case study and go sell into the enterprise. This has been one of the biggest advantages of like the American startup ecosystem, which is huge. And some of the startups are big enough to be considered enterprises in and of themselves. The total dollar value, or yen, or however you want to slice it, compared to what's happening in the US, Japan is far, far behind. Whether you measure it in terms of total value invested or as a percentage of the GDP, it's 1/8 or something. It's very tiny.
Yes.
So there's still a lot of room to grow there. You know, 30,000 feet, I think that's where it is. Some of the most positive trends I see are things like, well, I mentioned the government support, which in the US, there is strong government support for startups, but it tends to be behind the scenes. Things like DARPA.
Japan, got you like research money.
Well, yeah, research money or direct investment. The CIA runs a really big investment fund. It's just they don't do press releases about it or hold events. There's a tremendous amount of government money flowing into startups. And that's always has been. That's a good thing. But in Japan, it makes more sense for the government to be more vocal about it. I think it provides kind of this halo effect, a legitimizing effect. It makes it easier for startups to work with government agencies and work with larger enterprises when certainly someone like Abe or Kishida is up on television saying, you know, startups are the future of innovation in Japan. That helps.
Yeah, I guess I could see. I mean, right now I know there's cities like Sapporo. We've interviewed Fukuoka City on our podcast, Shibuya. I think Hamamatsu is starting, Aichi, Kobe. But yeah, I could definitely see if with a national announcement that could galvanize even more cities.
I mean, it's a very good trend. If we want to drop down from that 30,000 foot view to the founder view, it's a little bit of a different perspective on those programs. But in terms of ecosystem support, I think it's amazing. It would have been really inconceivable 10 years ago.
Yeah, because I think even the startup visa itself is not even 10 years old, I believe, right?
No, most of this is pretty new stuff.
And I kind of want to ask you that question because for me, I've started my company before like where all these things popped up. So it's been really interesting to see like, I don't know, from my end, because me, I've been more ground level. I was like, wow, a lot has actually happened.
Yeah. And that's, I think, an important thing for founders have to keep in mind that all of these programs are fantastic. They can make your life a bit easier. Take advantage of them, look into them, they're great. But in the overall effort of running and growing a successful startup, you know, this is rounding error type stuff. The real challenge is still always in building something worthwhile for a customer, acquiring customers, growing revenues, you know, recruiting the right team. That's still where the hard work is. And that has not changed in the last 25 years. I don't think it ever will.
Yeah, exactly. And I think when I've mentored startups as well, it's just like the first question is like, do people actually want your product?
You know, there is a particular social good accelerator that I mentor at every year. And it's almost heartbreaking for me. They tend to bring me in to talk about pricing strategy and go to market because I think it's just hard to find mentors to speak to that. And all of these founders, they tend to be very new founders. Most don't quite have product market fit. And they've gotten so much validation, like you're helping the world and you're following your dreams. And isn't that great? And I come in here and say, okay, great. Who's going to buy this? Like, yeah, no, unfortunately, people don't buy things because it's the right thing to do. Yeah, they've said it's good, but have they said they'll pay 2,000 yen a month for it? Let's work this through, see what we can build. At the end of this session, my reviews are either split between like founders who are like, this was the best 45 minutes of the entire program, or founders who are like, this mentor didn't care about my startup at all.
I can totally see that.
Yeah.
Like I've seen a bunch on climate change. It's like, wait, are you an employee management app or are you a climate reduction?
Well, it's hard, man. I mean, it's almost like I feel like it's almost too much pressure to put on these. I won't even call them founders because most of them are still students or, you know, early 20s. But I really think there are some problems. There are some problems that capitalism just isn't necessarily the right tool to address. And some of these environmental problems, some educational problems. And that's speaking as, you know, I'll stack my capitalist credentials up to anyone. my whole career has been investing and starting companies. But, you know, there's some things that, maybe startups aren't the right tool. Or maybe they're, you know, not the whole solution anyway.
No, I agree with that. And actually, the episode coming after yours is exactly about approaching VCs about getting funding. And I think one topic that I really wanted to try to educate people more on is, you know, what actually is a VC fundable company? You know, there's nothing wrong with it not being a VC fundable company, but just understanding that so you don't set yourself up for...
Yeah, exactly. The way I always explain it is like when you take VC money, you are signing up for a very specific growth plan, right? You're going to risk the company to double or nothing. And if that succeeds, you're going to do it again. And if that succeeds, you're going to do it again. And like, if you know that going in and you're up for that, that's awesome. You'll have a great relationship with your VC because that's what they want you to do. But if you want to like grow slow and be cautious and build a lifestyle company, yeah, you're probably setting yourself up for some conflicts.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think one thing I don't think that enough is mentioned about, but we're also producing another episode, like really understanding the VC's psychology. I think one point that I really wanted to get through is, so you're approaching a VC who's an associate. They have a boss. Mm. The boss wants to, let's say, provide a return on investment for the investors into the fund. Like, of course, they would like to help people, but, you know, they also at the same time would not like to get yelled by their boss, you know, for introducing a company that's not venture fundable. So it's...
Oh, I see. Really, yeah, yeah.
You know, it's hard for them to take risks. And so, like, these are the types of companies they like to invest in. And if you're a match, it's easy. But if not, you know, it's really hard for, like, associates and even to even consider pushing up to their boss.
Well, I mean, that's good advice for a founder as well. I mean, definitely before pitching a VC, go to their homepage, look at their portfolio, see what kind of startups they invest in. Usually, because I mean, the VCs, it's in their best interest to make that information as clear as possible. And most of them do.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Scaling Japan. In addition to serving as your fine host, I also provide advisory and coaching services to business owners who want to 2x, 5x, and even 10x their business. So stop holding your company and your team and your employees back, and let me help you and your company scale. Find more information at scalingyourcompany.com. Now back to the episode.
So I think I've mentioned about, you know, the startup visa. You mentioned about, you know, the national government, you know, trying to get more involved in the startup ecosystem. And what are some other changes you've seen in maybe the last, let's say, 10, 5 or 3 years?
Well, I think one of the most important has been the shift in the attitude of Japanese enterprise towards startups. Not important, not just important because of sales, but starting with the sales. So in the dot-com era, it was next to impossible for a startup to work directly with a first-tier enterprise. You'd be pushed down through like 4 levels of subcontractors. And you know, you're not going to do anything innovative through 4 levels of subcontractors. You're just not. But now every large enterprise in Japan practically has a startup outreach program where they're trying to work with startups. Some are better at it than others, but there's this desire to do so. And I think that is, you know, going back to what I mentioned before about the government programs, the programs themselves are great, but the real impact is this halo effect. When Prime Minister Abe got on TV and literally was saying, startup innovation is the future of Japan. This is the future of economic growth. The first time he did that, you know, every CEO in Japan the next morning was talking to his staff saying, what are these startup things and why aren't we working with them yet?
Gotcha.
Right? And Kishida and Medi and all of these programs have continued that drumbeat. And so there's been a tremendous effort to kind of restructure enterprise procurement to enable them to work with startups. And that's been transformative, not just because of it's easier to make sales, which is nice, but also because enterprises are a much bigger part. They have a much bigger influence in Japan than they do in the U.S. startup ecosystem. And that's both because of the amount of corporate venture capital on the funding side, but also on the go-to-market. So, for example, I think in Japan, brands have a lot more power, particularly over the consumer, than they do in the U.S. So, for example, Japanese people say that like consumers are conservative, they don't like change, and that's not quite true. So, for example, if Suntory introduced 20 new flavors of canned coffee for the spring, right? That would be great. People would want to try all 20. They'd have little characters on them. It, you know, novelty, awesome. But if some new startup introduced a new flavor of canned coffee, well, who the hell are these guys? And why should, you know what I mean?
No, exactly.
It's
Our Suntory has a proven record of having some big hits.
Well, they have that consumer trust. And that trust is so incredibly important in Japan, whether it's a consumer or a B2B side. And so I think Japanese consumers certainly are willing to try new things, but it needs to come from a trusted source. Mm-hmm. Businesses are just, you know, they're more genuinely conservative than their U.S. counterparts.
But I would definitely agree. Like, that's been my experience when I was actually just like several months ago when I was a resident mentor for 500 Global. I would say a lot of the companies in the C to Series A range, foreign companies who are doing their Japan market entry through 500 Global's accelerator, a lot of them were able to get meetings with large, you know, tier one corporations. And some of them were even able to get second conversations. We'll see how some of them go. But yeah, pretty much a lot of them in the seat. And they had like teams of people in the corporation to meet with these founders, either as EVC or just to adopt new technology.
Well, yeah, and as a heads up to founders who might find themselves in this situation, it's a good situation to be in. There's nothing bad about it, but make sure you know why you're in that meeting and that the other side is in the meeting for the same reason. The reason I say this is a lot of companies, their startup outreach, they need to talk to a certain number of startups, make a certain number of proposals, and meeting with you might end up with just another bullet point on a PowerPoint presentation. If you know, go into those meetings knowing what you want from that company. And you know, it's sales, man. You know, you just get the ball in the goal. But too many of the meetings end with like, this is great, you know, this is great technology. We're really impressed. We'd like to continue our discussions. And yeah. just know what you want out of those meetings going in, and it'll be a lot more productive.
And this might be interesting, but I'll say the most common rejection that I've heard was that we don't know how to support you. We like you. You're very interesting, but we don't know how to support you.
Well, I mean, like I say, that's the startup has to come in with like, well, here's how we want you to support us. Exactly. We want to launch a proof of concept in a secondary market, or we want $2 million of investment to be put towards launching this product in the real estate sector that you work with in this team. I mean, you gotta do your homework, because most of the time the enterprise is not going to do it for you.
So I want to ask you, like, so in 2023, I think one, you could dive deeper if you'd like, but what are some other trends you're seeing in the startup ecosystem in Japan in 2023 and maybe potentially 2024?
So I'd say there's an increasing appetite for going global for Japanese startups, which I think is long overdue. And there's been a lot of people, myself included, who's been pushing on that for a while. More bigger global ambitions from Japanese founders, which is awesome. In terms of sectors, I think AI is going to be big across the board. There's been a couple of waves of AI in Japan. I don't think it's not going to be coming from their fundamental research, but in terms of integrating with existing processes and databases, I think there's a huge opportunity there. There's a lot of really cool stuff going on in medicine and robotics and the intersection of those two, or even those three, if you want to put AI on top of it. But I haven't really seen many. I've seen so many great ideas and great technology, but I haven't really seen much in the way of like, okay, this is a startup that's going to disrupt an entire industry or even make a huge impact on an entire industry. But it's in there somewhere, I'm sure.
Yeah, also, like, you think, are there any industries that are really ripe for foreign entrepreneurs to kind of dive in?
You know, I don't think that it's an interesting question. The answer is unsatisfying in that, like, it's easiest for foreigners to break into things like tourism and segments where the customer base is largely foreign, but those are very niche markets. Even tourism, the amount that as a foreigner you can operate is it's very small compared to the Japanese speaking. So I my approach is the value proposition of your startup should not in any way be related to your foreignness or Japanese-ness. It's you're solving a problem. Now, when it comes time to make your sales pitches and get meetings, you can leverage the foreignness as you know to the hilt. But in terms of like the core value proposition, I just don't think in those ways. I don't think being a foreigner or not is kind of irrelevant to me.
Gotcha. No, I kind of says, the focus is, can you actually build? I mean, the numbers depend on the VCs, but, you know, like, are you targeting something that could generate $100 million annual revenue?
Yeah.
And tourism, if you're just even like, you know, that's really, unless you really get a lot of legit, there's not enough foreigners in Japan to generate that much revenue.
Yeah. I mean, it can be a good business. I know people who are running successful tourism-based business, but they're not a venture fundable business.
Same minds. We did Japanese language. It's a very solid business, but it's definitely not venture backable.
Yeah.
Yes, so I think those are some interesting. Yeah, the health tech does seem pretty interesting. I keep hearing the word DX, but could you tell us a little bit more about what's all this DX about?
Yeah, let's unpack that. So DX, digital transformation, it's hard to define it because it means very different things to very different people. But fundamentally, it is like, so in the January episode of Disrupting Japan, I did a 150-year history of Japanese software development. And I talks specifically about this is why Japanese enterprise systems are 30, 40 years behind the times and why it's hurting Japanese innovation as a whole. And so DX is basically fixing that problem. So it's not just getting people to use computers, they're already using computers, but it's getting enterprise and government to use computers in a modern way, use global best practices, not necessarily global standard software per se, but global approaches to become more efficient with it. And I think that it's going to require a bigger change than just the technology. So METI recently released a report saying that the digital transformation plans are going to result in, I think it was like 300,000 or 600,000 empty vacancies. Like, we need this many people to do digital transformation.
Uh-huh, gotcha.
Yeah, but no, that is using the current system integration model, which is like, right? And like, no, throw all of that out. That's part of the problem. That's what got us into this problem in the first place.
That is hilarious. And just for the audience, a system integrator, I mean, they can do various things, but basically it's a kind of a one-stop solution shop for IT.
Yeah, they'll come and build your computer system, your internal system. They do a lot of custom work. And they'll connect it to different systems, they'll do maintenance. And it's just that's the whole model that needs to be thrown to the wayside. And I think this is why B2B SaaS startups are in an incredibly strong position in Japan. You've got a lot of enterprises. So the value of SaaS software is that it kind of allows you to leapfrog a whole generation. You don't come in there with an army of integrators and customization. It's like, this is the product. It's stupidly cheap compared to what you're running now. You have almost no options. This is how it works. Sign here. And it's not 3,000 man hours to get it running. It's a few hundred dollars, a couple of days of programmer time, and we're done. And so I think that's going to be the driver of a lot of enterprise digital transformation. I think that, and to be fair, I think METI realizes this. They just can't come out and say, like, the systems integrator model needs to die. You know, government can't say things like that. But looking at the numbers, that's pretty obvious that the systems integrator model won't get us to a meaningful digital transformation.
And I think for the audience, if you were to see, even large corporations often have system integrator, say, maybe subsidiary. And so it's
right. Most of the Keiretsu groups, the large corporate groups, will have a specific subsidiary systems integrator, which has, they're kind of, the rest of the companies, the rest of the corporate group is kind of captive to this one integrator. That is also something that's starting to change and should have changed 30 years ago.
Gotcha. Well, could you tell us more about like some of the catalysts for the changes?
Well, it's economic, really. I think in the bubble, and even after the bubble burst, like up through the 90s, when profits were good, the fact that, you know, you were paying twice as much as you should. Well, it wasn't that big a deal because it's all in the same corporate group and half your business is coming from others in the corporate group. So like, yeah, we'll let it slide. Yeah. But, you know, it doesn't work that way anymore. And I think the bank mergers were the big one. The series of bank mergers, a lot of those happened across Keiretsu lines. And the banks, they're not like the foundation of the Keiretsu system, but they're an incredibly important part of it. And so breaking those barriers, I think, just kind of made it an acceptable conversation to start talking about, well, we need to look at other options. We need to look outside our group. It's been a slow ongoing process.
Yeah, but it's been nice to see at least more softwares, you know, that can integrate. Because I know what the problem with those system integrators sometimes is, you know, you might have a great solution and you might not be able to integrate it to your current one.
Yeah. Well, and to be clear, I'm not against systems integrators. I mean, the world needs good integrators, but the current model of the current Japanese model is kind of a customer capture where the integrator is telling the customer what systems they should develop, what should be implemented, rather than the other way around. That's the model that needs to change. And to the credit, there are a lot of the system integrators, or at least people in those system integrators, who realize that and are trying to be more consultative and you know, operate at a higher level. Yeah.
Cool. So I guess next I want to ask you, like, what gaps do you still see in the current startup ecosystem in Japan?
You know, really, I'd say the biggest one is a meaningful sense of community. And I think that certainly in the earlier days, one of the things that Silicon Valley really had going for it was this pay it forward culture. Both in a formal situation where successful founders would become angel investors and share their expertise that way, but also in just a very strong sense of community that needs to develop a lot more. And in fact, this is not just my own subjective evaluation, though it's that too. Startup Genome is a research organization. They research startup ecosystems around the world. And in the last 2 years, Tokyo was ranked number 9 and number 12, respectively. But in both cases, Tokyo received the lowest score in community and connectedness.
Oh.
Yeah. And I think that to do something new and interesting requires founders to bounce ideas off each other. It requires this kind of collaboration. It requires people to kind of check. It requires a more fluid workforce, which is starting to happen now. But I think that the biggest gap really is in that sense of community. And if you look at a place like Fukuoka, I think one of their strengths, in fact, maybe their only strength, because they don't have a big population, they don't have a lot of VCs, but they have this incredibly strong community within the startup ecosystem.
I have noticed as well, where everyone in Fukuoka knows each other in the startup world.
And the startup ecosystem, certainly in the early days, you know, these days, the government support has just been fantastic. But in the early days, it was just shining a spotlight. So the community would say, well, we want to have this startup event. And, you know, the government would say, well, that sounds good. There's no budget, but you can use this facility. And hey, maybe we'll have the mayor come and give a speech about the importance of innovation. And like, oh, perfect. And that's like exactly the perfect thing that government needs to do to bootstrap a community. And that sense of startup-run community is still very strong today. So I think that Tokyo needs more of that. And we see the same thing in smaller markets like Kyoto is very much like that too. Very tight-knit, very outgoing startup community there.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. I know there's my next guest, Skylar Cole from Incubate Fund. They created, I think, Startup Co-Creation Group. Mm-hmm. So I think it might be them or someone else, but they're doing their weekly startup lunches where I think founders can meet up every week in Tokyo. And I know in Osaka as well, I think they're just trying to start it out, but it's two founders, like Asa from, I think, Skyscanner, and I think Dwayne Greck from, I think, X Lab, I think it's something like that.
And that's great. I mean, we need more of that. And you know, I think in a sense that it is easier for foreigners to start building those communities than it is for Japanese, I think. Just culturally, I think coming from America, as an American saying, oh, you know, there should be this meetup group. I'm going to start one. I'll buy some pizza and beer, invite my friend. Totally natural. But I think a lot of Japanese feel that if they just put their hand up and say, okay, I'm going to start this founder meetup group, people would be asking, you know, like, well, who the hell are you, right?
Uh-huh.
So I think there is a bit of reluctance to be the person to start it, even if everyone's thinking like, wow, if that existed, I'd go. So the more people out there trying to start it, the better.
One of the common challenges I see with my consulting clients is not having any staff internally who can drive marketing strategy and execution to the next level. This really limits the growth trajectory of a company, especially for a leader like you that wants to go from 30 million to 500 million yen a year and does not have the time to spend years on learning through trial and error. To solve this problem, I'm launching a marketing agency that can help companies like yours to increase leads and closing rates through SEO, Google Maps, content marketing, and websites that convert. Head over to scalingyourcompany.com and book a free consultation. Let's talk about what your business needs are, where your current strategy is letting you down, and how we can help you see real results with the methods I've successfully implemented at multiple companies myself. Thank you.
Gotcha. So that's interesting, or how you mentioned it, like, you know, who the hell are you to? But I don't, if you could dive more deeper in this topic, yeah, like kind of why, like, you know, the barriers for creating the community in Japan, I think that'll be, I'm pretty interested to hear.
Well, I think it's just, I mean, culturally, you know, in Japan, you have to be very sensitive about stepping on someone's toes or doing something that might be considered a slight. Or if someone else is starting a community and you start a so-called rival community, it can be a real headache. One of the advantages of being a foreigner in Japan is you're sort of, I mean, you can't totally ignore those rules, but to a large extent, you're outside them. So I don't know. I just get that sense that it takes more effort, more emotional effort for a Japanese person to start a founder community than it does for a foreigner to start a founder community.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious, and I do agree. I think Honda Keisuke might have funded, I think it's not Pivot, but... I think it's called Protocol. Yeah, and I did find it's a protocol dot, and it's 3000. I don't know how they got that name, but
Protocol. Okay.
Yeah, with three O's, and it's the first person that pops up is angel investor Keisuke Honda. So I'm assuming he's invested in it. Keisuke Honda was a former professional soccer player who played for AC Milan, who is now a pretty hardcore angel investor.
Excellent.
And I know they're trying. This is kind of a new one. I haven't met the CEO, but a friend was going to introduce me. But yeah, it's kind of curious to see if they can. I think they're going to try to create. But it seems like they're probably trying to go with the hybrid. It's not just Japanese, maybe more foreigner. So maybe they're.
I mean, that's the angle. Fine. That's good. I mean, the only thing. So, I mean, a lot of these communities, and I don't know about this one at all. So, I mean, this is not a comment on this project because I know nothing about it. But a lot of times these communities, sometimes people tend to build them in order to like monetize them. And that tends to fall apart pretty quickly. I don't know. But I mean, it's just, I don't have an easy solution. If I did, I would do it and fix the problem, but I don't. Mm. So, but I do think that community and that kind of open collaboration in a way that's really led by founders, not led by VCs or by enterprise, is really the only thing I'd say is truly missing or lacking here now.
Gotcha. And could you elaborate why that's so important for it to be founder-led?
At its core, I think it's that founders understand what the needs are, where the government programs, the enterprise programs are great. They should keep doing those. But that's not a substitute for founder-led initiatives. So, for example, Kei Danren's program of the startup matching, KIX, it's a fantastic program designed to help startups work with enterprises. And it's focused on that one particular function, and it's really good at it. But it's not a general forum for founders to exchange ideas, for founders to collaborate with each other. Perhaps it's something that a government or third party can put together. But every time I've seen a community like that anywhere in the world, it's been put together and led by the founders themselves.
Gotcha. It's more of a universal kind of thing. Yeah, it makes sense. And when I've spoken to founders, I think one of their biggest frustration points is like, it's helpful, but they don't really understand our needs.
Yeah, but that's cool. I mean, they're big enterprises. You're not supposed to understand their needs. You're the founder, for God's sake. You're supposed to understand their needs, right? That's the way the game is played.
No, that's a great way of phrasing it. No, it is true. Yeah, like I mean, for the corporate side, like I mean, it's good. I mean, they don't really. It'll be nice, but they don't really need to know it. Like, it's not like their life is based on it.
No, they can't. I mean, they for corporate startup outreach programs, the people who are working there have probably never worked at a startup. They're incredibly well-intentioned, but they don't understand startups at a level where they can be expected to say, here's what's missing in the ecosystem, or here's how we can get these groups together.
And could I ask you one last question?
Absolutely.
Okay, excellent. I wanted to ask you, let's say if I were to create a startup ecosystem as a founder to get more other founders, how could we actually get more Japanese participants?
I'm probably not the right person to ask about that. I have noticed that most communities will tend to drift into mostly foreigner, overwhelmingly foreigner, overwhelmingly Japanese.
Mm.
I don't know why that is. It might just be one language just naturally goes one way or another. It might just be chance. I don't think there's a core reason it has to be that way.
That's a good point. I'm trying to think of the events.
But I think more of thinking of in terms of like an organized community with regular gatherings. I mean, those are great too. but it's more of a sense of community. So people who are just being very free and willing to make introductions, both to individuals or like, oh, hey, you know, I know this startup that's got a product that might be good. You should talk to them. You know, I know this developer who's, you know, he's not really that happy where he is now. Maybe I can introduce him to you. It's more of that sense of community that I think is most important rather than formalized meetups and things. I think the meetups are almost more of an extension or maybe in some ways a starting point, but in any event, supplemental to having that sense of community.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And yes, I think once you meet those types of people, I mean, it's easy, but like, yeah, just meeting them for the first time, because I do have some Japanese friends who are exited founders and who are more chilling. And,
well, yeah, but my point is like, it's not a matter of meeting those kind of people, because everyone in the community is those kind of people. Sometimes the most important, most valuable mentor you can have is someone who is just 18 months ahead of you. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, where it's really fresh in their head.
And that you'll be able to like relate to. And I think that like, well, I want to find someone who is successfully exited and he can mentor me. Nothing wrong with that, but that person's head probably is going to be in a very different place than you are now. Helping each other is what's needed. Not so much the like striving to find the quote best mentor you can.
Gotcha. I think I finally got what you meant.
Awesome.
Yeah. And it does. It does make sense. It's just the number, and you know, just even having knowing multiple people who's been in a similar situation, you know, and who just raised that, you know, that stage or that round of funding, or you know, they're able to go, or like maybe your Series Seed, and they're able to raise A and can really help you stand out.
Yeah.
No, thank you very much for that. And so, yeah, we're definitely going to link to the Disrupting Japan podcast.
Thank you. Please give it a listen. It's a labor of love.
And do you have any other asks or anything you'd like to share with the audience?
No, right now. I mean, just check out Disrupting Japan. Let me know what you think. Thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
Cool. Yeah. And I highly recommend the Disrupting Japan podcast. There's a lot of guests who are very successful, and maybe they haven't done too many interviews in English, and you get to listen to them and them share their experiences, their insights, you know, their hard-earned knowledge. And I think Tim has done a great job at really bringing, you know, the foreign founders as well, but especially the Japanese founders, and providing that knowledge in English.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm glad you enjoy it.
And I am part of the community who does want to try it. I think you've pioneered it, and I'm part of the group that wants to help pass it on for what you've provided to us.
All right. Thanks so much.
Take it easy, Tim.
Bye now.